Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
And today, we want to focus on what teenagers and young adults are experiencing and the ways they can get help. If you are a parent with questions, what questions do you have? And if you're an adult, I want to hear from you about your experiences. You can call. The number is 651-227-6000. Or leave me a message on Twitter. I'm at Angela Davis, NPR. I have two guests in the studio with me this morning. Liz Babkin works for NAMI Minnesota. That's the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And Liz is a parent and youth educator for NAMI. Liz is also a young woman who openly talks about living with anxiety. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning.
I also have Dr. Lisa Herman Lovelace in the studio with me. She's a licensed clinical psychologist in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and New York. She's also the founder of Synergy E-Therapy, and she goes by the name Dr. Lisa. Nice to meet you.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
So, Dr. Lisa, I'll begin with you. You work with a lot of teenagers and young adults, people in their 20s. What are the most common mental health conditions among them? You know, we hear a lot about anxiety and depression. What are you seeing?
Yes, I work with a lot of teens. I've worked with teens for probably two decades in a lot of different cities, in Chicago, in New York, and here in Minnesota. I'm at Allina Health as well, and a lot of what we see is anxiety and stress, just really a lot of worry, depression, sadness. All of these things are very common in kids really all across the nation. But in particular, lately, the anxiety and the stress has been probably the most prominent common disorder that I've been working with.
But when I hear about anxiety and stress, isn't that part of being a teenager?
It is. It's part of being a human being.
Right.
A lot of teens these days are more aware, I think, of their emotions and what they're feeling. They don't always know what it is and what to do about it. But yes, it is part of being a teenager. It's such a huge developmental leap, right? Going from middle school to high school and then graduating high school. There's so much going on cognitively and emotionally and physically. And it's really, really hard to understand where they fit in.
So as a psychologist, share with us, I want to talk about the signs of a mental illness, because mm-hmm. you just mentioned developmentally, you mm-hmm. know, young adults, teenagers are changing mm-hmm. and their hormones are changing. Mm-hmm. But what are the signs of a mental illness?
Yeah, so it is a little different. And I get this question a lot from parents or guardians that I'm working with and I'm working with their teen or young adult is, how do I know if this is normal? Like, how do I know if this is typical? Because, you know, teenagers are hard to deal
right.
with. They're moody, they're anxious, they're sad, they cry easily sometimes. But what we're looking for as a clinical psychologist or a licensed mental health therapist is this severe? Is it lasting a long time? So are there symptoms that you might be noticing, like the irritability or the sadness, or maybe they're withdrawn or they don't like the activities they used to like? Is this really severe? Is it lasting for several weeks or really a long time? And then is this causing impairment in their daily functioning? So the way that we look at that is, how are they doing at school? How are they doing at home and with their friends? So if it's really causing a lot of trouble, a lot of difficulty, that's when we look at it and say, this is getting in the way. And it may not just be the blues or sadness or dealing with a breakup or a change. This might be something that's really impairing their functioning, and we need to seek treatment so that they can get the help they deserve.
Is it getting in the way of being able to live
exactly.
their lives? So, Liz, I mentioned in your introduction, you're a community educator. And I should also let people know you're 24 years old and you spend a lot of time speaking to groups about your personal experience with anxiety as a teenager. So what is it that you talk about or that you it's important for you to share with people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I spent so many years of my life not even fully understanding what was kind of going on because, you know, we have conversations about how anxiety is normal, how it's a regular part of life. You know, if you're starting to struggle, you talk to family or talk to other people and they'll say, you know, it's just a teenager thing. You'll get over it. It's no big deal. Or, you know, everyone gets added anxious or depressed sometimes. It just goes away. And then, you know, for me, like when I started noticing things that were popping up and when life became difficult, like, of course, I listened to those narratives. Of course, I was thinking, you know, well, okay, well, then it's clear something that's wrong with me. Maybe I'm the broken one. Maybe there's something kind of going wrong with me and I'm the weak person. And especially when you live with anxiety and you have those thoughts in your head, that's kind of what anxiety is. It's not just worries and fears. It's this constant analyzation of who you are as a person, what you did wrong, all these sorts of figures. And I would lie awake at night thinking, you know, all the little tiny details that I did wrong, everything that I could have done better throughout the day. And at no point in time did I think this isn't normal. I just thought I'm broken somehow. I have to hide this from people because if people find out, then they're going to realize I'm different.
So if I'm living in the house with you, if I'm in class with you, do I notice it? Can I see it? Or because you talked about the thoughts in your mind, what you're thinking. But would I have noticed that if I were someone who was interacting with you on a regular basis?
Yeah, and that's the tricky part. I mean, unless if in cases even now right now or even back then, unless I'm having a really hard day, you might not notice. You know, we talk a lot of the times how a lot of the times mental illnesses are invisible illnesses. You might not necessarily see them on the surface. Yeah, if I'm having a panic attack or if I'm having a really rough time leaving the house or something like that, then you might start to notice and kind of see it there. But because so much of it is happening in my head and because especially when I was in high school, I was trying so hard to hide it, you wouldn't have noticed. You would have just thought maybe I'm just having a little bit of a rough day or, you know, maybe there's something wrong, but you wouldn't have necessarily been able to see all those thoughts and feelings that were going on in my head.
So give me some examples. I think about what caused me anxiety in high school. A lot of it was comparison. Mm-hmm. You know, what is someone else wearing? What does someone else's hair look like? What, you know, what other people, the activities other people are doing? It seemed like everybody was living a better life than me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sort of some of what you're thinking or?
Similar. Yeah. For me, a lot of it had to do with interpersonal relationships. I struggled all the time thinking about what people thought about me, what I was going through. You know, if I had fallings out with friends, I wouldn't even think about, you know, what they did wrong or what they said. I'd be like, oh, clearly I said something wrong. Clearly I did something there. And my brain just wouldn't let it go. I'd think about it for hours and hours and hours and hours. And at the same time, too, you know, I spent so much time constantly hyperfixating on even the tiniest conversations. You know, I'd sit there and think about, oh, that mistake that I made there or something else like that. And I, at the same time, I'd have all these thoughts in my head that were telling me, you know, the reason that you're not making as good of friends who are, the reason that you're not getting these amazing grades or you're not this star person is because you're a bad person in general. This is all your fault. You're a weak person. You know, everything about that. It never occurred to me that there was an outside world around me that could have influenced me because my brain was trying so hard to convince me that it was everything to do with me.
And Dr. Lisa, I see you're nodding.
I am.
What she's describing is that familiar. Do you hear a lot of that?
It's spot on. A lot of the teens that I work with, this is what they're saying. This is what they experience. And can you imagine how hard that might be to live every day with such negative thought pattern going through your mind and really internalizing everything that's happening in your world and you're seeing it as a negative? How did I screw this up? What am I doing wrong? Why aren't people, you know, liking me this way or loving me in this way? It must be because of me. And it is really, really difficult to, you know, hear kids really experiencing these things. And what do they do about it? What are they supposed to do with that? And like you said, you don't always know that this isn't normal. Like, how are other people living? Maybe they're living the same way. Is this typical? Is this not typical? Do I talk to somebody about it? What do I do if I don't know who to talk to? And then people just kind of, it just sinks and it just stays there and you just kind of live with it for years. And then, as we know, anxiety and even depression are really physical diseases, right? That's how sometimes we know that something is off because you get really bad tummy aches or really bad headaches or you're really tense or you get shaky. So the physical aspect of the mental health is really sometimes where people begin. And that's where they go to the doctor and they're like, I'm having a heart attack, right? I'm having ulcers. What's going on? And hopefully that will be an in, is usually through the medical provider. It's mm-hmm. not always through
the
a parent
primary
or guardian.
Care
yeah.
doctor. And mm-hmm. so that leads me to my next question. Who tends to notice the symptoms first?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great question. I think it depends on the person, on the teenager. And just on the household, you know, how open are they in talking about mental health? How are they, you know, at school? Are they close to teachers? Do they already see a counselor at school? So how do we know? I mean, it's hard. I could look at somebody, and I have groups at Alina Health where I just on Monday had a group of 8 kids, and we talked about me being here today, and I'm like, what do you want them to know? And, you know, what they're saying is we just keep it inside. We think we can deal with it. And hopefully you're noticing some of these signs and symptoms, more irritability or the tummy aches or missing school is usually a big one. Like, I don't want to go. That school refusal can be huge. So it's usually a behavior sometimes that we're seeing. And then we have to kind of go underneath it and say, what's manifesting here? Is there, you know, anxiety, depression, a learning issue, a chronic medical condition that we just don't know about yet either? So a lot of times it is from parents realizing or the school realizing that something seems a little bit difficult or a little bit off, and then it gets started.
And close friends may notice, but I would imagine a reluctance to say anything or just not knowing, well, who would you say something to? Yeah.
I mean, I tend to notice, especially when I go into high school classrooms, that once you start getting students to click the dots within themselves to kind of put two and two together and talk about it, then they might start having those conversations with friends. Or their friends might be like, hey, you know, my friend who is angry all the time or who isn't coming to school anymore, maybe there's something else kind of going on there. And then they'll start those conversations. But, you know, I think back to my own high school experiences. I spent years thinking that I was entirely alone, that no one else believed what I was going through. And then I talked to some of my high school friends, same ones, who also were going through stuff, and none of us communicated to each other. But I think about, what if we'd had that conversation earlier? What if we started talking about these things or other people brought it up? Maybe then we could have had a discussion about it, and then things would have been figured out a little bit sooner.
So what brought you to treatment? What initially, I know initially your anxiety was not treated, but something changed.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was definitely a little bit of a slow process. I mean, again, I didn't fully even realize that I was going through this until I got to college. I remember a little bit more of an openness to talk about it, where I had just like a really, really rough day, and I went to go talk to my school counselor, and I still wasn't fully honest with her about what I was experiencing, mostly because I didn't even fully know the full scope of it until I looked back at it. But I remember her specifically saying that instead of those things that I was so worried that everyone would say, you know, it's all your fault, you did something wrong, she just sat me down and said, hey, I'm so sorry you're going through this. This must be really difficult for you. And I know that sounds like a very simple statement, but up until that point in my life, I didn't think anyone had told me that before or maybe really pushed it home for me. So just that kind of openness of, okay, I'm here to listen to you, I'm here to talk, that kind of set the spark in motion. And then when I got to college, you know, the attitude around mental health was just totally different. Suddenly everyone was talking about it. Suddenly I had friends telling me about their diagnoses, and I was hearing about a lot more of this information. And when you get that information, and on top of that, you know, my school provided free mental health services for students who were attending, I had those resources, I had those conversations, I was able to put those pieces together. And then I was able to kind of start my recovery process.
So to continue our conversation, we were talking about resources and what's available. And Liz, you said that when you were in high school, that was when you first really became aware that you were living with anxiety. But it was in college. Something happened at college that really allowed you to seek treatment. So tell me about that college experience.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, it took a little while for sure to kind of for things to fall in place. But I think the differences between what happened in high school versus what happened in college was just the conversation was just so much more open. People were talking about it a lot more. My school was very, very upfront and open. They had a presentation for us the first week about what mental health services the school offers and how it's included in our tuition and all these other things. And when you have a conversation like that, and when you have a level of openness, you know, and you know that there's a place that you can go to talk with a counselor free of charge, you know, it started to open the conversation for me of, you know, I don't know if I have a mental illness or not, but maybe I can go talk to someone about it. And that kind of started that open door process. From that to talking with friends, talking with other people, talking with mental health professionals, it really kind of started putting things together for me. And over the course of a couple of years, I started learning strategies for how to manage my anxiety. I started learning different ways and different ways to communicate with other people, talk about the things that I was feeling rather than just keeping them in my head. And so much of it became not only just kind of working through my mental illness, but really learning how to take care of my mental health at the same time. And it started with having access to resources and knowing that I could talk to people who were aware of the situation.
And Dr. Lisa, when we talk about resources and getting help, mm-hmm. I know that Minnesota, we don't do too well when we look at the ratio of like high school counselors to students who need some type of mental health support. Mm-hmm. We do terribly on that. What do you make of that, just the lack of resources that are available?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. And I think, Liz, what you experienced too, it's not for, you know, people aren't trying. It's just the resources aren't there. We have a lot of great counselors doing the best, but they can only manage so many kids in so many schools across the nation. And we know in Minnesota, the suicide rate is up 40% plus from the CDC in the last 16 years. We're higher than the national average for 15 to 19-year-olds and just overall. So we know that there's something that needs to be done. Resources clearly are lacking, but at the same time, we also just don't have one place for people to go and see everything that's out there. And so being in the mental health field, I clearly know a lot of the resources, but when I talk about it to other people, whether it's a school counselor or parents, they never heard about it. So there's a disconnect between what's really out there and how is it getting to the public. And I think what you're offering, it makes this happen so people understand the resources.
So for a young adult who's not going to college or who has left high school, what kind of support systems can they turn to for help? Because, you know, Liz mentioned that being mm-hmm. on the campus and then mm-hmm. it was part of the discussion mm-hmm. and there were resources there. But mm-hmm. if the college campus is not an environment that's an option for someone, where else could a young person go to?
Right. Well, I've got a few things that I think could be helpful. Alina Health started a free online resource called Change to Chill. Anybody can go to this website, and they really are talking a lot about what is stress, what is anxiety, how do you stress less. There's a lot of parent resources, community resources, and they actually will go into schools for free and really educate the educators and give resources to the kids and to the parents so that they really learn about anxiety and stress and what to do with it, and they're teaching guided imagery and yoga and stinking thinking and all of these things that we as psychologists and therapists bring to our clients individually. They can bring it kind of to the schools.
What has to happen? The school district has to reach out to Alina Health and request this? Or how do you connect a school with Change to Chill?
Yeah, they have a Change to Chill school partnership where they go into the classroom. So just having a school parent or teacher go online, having the administrative staff just know that this is out there. It's free to have them come in and really understand stress in their school system. And that's a great resource. Yeah.
I mentioned our listeners can call in and ask a question. And we do want to encourage that. The number to call is 651-227-6000. And I want to bring in now Carmen, who is listening in Minneapolis, who has a question. Good morning, Carmen.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I've really been enjoying the conversation today and also all month, too. I'm really appreciating what your positive attention you're drawing to mental health. So my question, and I've kind of been thinking about this all month as well, is a little on the flip side of what you're discussing. My husband and I have a daughter who's 14 years old, and she has never really liked school ever from kindergarten day one, and has gone through, and she is smart and bright, and she's gotten through fine, but this past couple of years, she's just kind of given up and is sort of just not doing her assignments and not really accepting help from her teachers. And I know, like, the psychologist at school and one of the other resource emotional behavior specialists have tried to help her, and she just refuses help, just kind of shuts down. I have approached her a few times about, well, maybe it would help to see a therapist, just, you know, to get some strategies, just to kind of help with your rethinking, a way to, you know, just somebody to talk to about mm-hmm. ways to cope. She's continuously, like, shut us down. You know, like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to talk to someone. I don't need help. So my question is, how do you get the reluctant patient, like, to a 14-year-old, like, we're
go.
All for it. We've got the resources. Mm-hmm. We'd love her to go. We think it's great, but she will not go. So do you have any ways I could try to help convince her to go?
Thank you, Carmen. Mm-hmm. Dr. Lisa?
Yeah, I'm happy to answer this question. And it's, you know, it's really tough for parents to know what to do when your child is not wanting to go to therapy, doesn't want to get tested to see if there's any learning disabilities or anything that's underneath the surface, or anxiety or depression. A lot of times I will suggest that let's take the focus off of her as, you know, this is something that you're struggling with. I can see that this is hard for you. I want you to go here and go to therapy and do all these things. I say, let's take that focus off of her and let's bring it back just to the family as a whole. And I also tell parents, let's just own it ourselves. So let's bring something like the Change to Chill website into your home. And as a family, we're going to have yoga night. And we're all going to get our yoga mats and we're going to do this together. So it's not about her per se. It's just this is what we're going to do to make our family healthier and learn different skills and techniques. There's lots of games that are out there to play where the parents kind of take it on, say, oh, my goodness, I'm feeling stressed. I'm feeling sad. What can we do as a family to have fun and really connect? Sometimes taking that focus off of the one person in the family where they're kind of feeling all that, maybe they're feeling shame or guilt or embarrassment, and that stops them from really wanting to explore this. That would be one suggestion that I would have.
Liz, any suggestions for?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's important to kind of think about maybe where she's coming from as well. You know, there are some teens who maybe just aren't quite there yet. Maybe they don't feel personally comfortable talking to a therapist yet or talking to a mental health professional. But really kind of analyzing where that's coming from and also maybe talking to them or seeing if they maybe feel like by going to a therapist or by reaching to a mental health professional that they have to acknowledge that something is wrong, that they're worried about their self-image, that they're worried about how people are going to react to it or kind of they'll be proven right, quote unquote. And so really kind of talking about what they're feeling and what they're processing. And, you know, and if they're not quite there yet to the point where they want to go to therapy, then maybe utilizing some of those kind of extra options, you know, letting them know and say, hey, you know, there's this thing called the crisis text line, which exists. You can text 741-741 if you're having a rough day. Sure, it's not a mental health therapist, but it is someone at the end of the line who is trained with mental health reasons who can talk to someone, you know, not necessarily just looking at it's therapy or bust, but what are the things in between that we can do to kind of work with them and not broaching it as you need to do these sort of things. Well, hey, what would work for you? What do you think you're kind of missing and what could be useful?
If I could piggyback on that, also maybe she wants to do painting or karate or, you know, take up bicycling. There's so many other hobbies and things that she could get involved in that are good for positive mental wellness that it might not be therapy. It might not be that she's going to go to college and do X, Y, and Z, but there's so many other resources that are good for our mental wellness.
Absolutely.
Tom is listening in St. Louis Park. And Tom, I'd like to bring you in the conversation to share your comment.
Great. Thank you, Angela. I'd like to get your guest's perspective on this. A number of us in St. Louis Park parents have noticed that there was quite a crisis, I guess I would say, in terms of depression and anxiety among high school students. And so about 4 years ago, a number of us got together and we decided to create with the students' leadership a student-run nonprofit coffee shop in St. Louis Park, which we call SLP Nest, SLP St. Louis Park. And the idea of this space is that it's close to school. Students can go there after school, just hang out. You don't have to have great grades. You don't have to buy anything. You don't have to buy a cup of coffee. You don't have to look a certain way. You can just hang there and meet friends and perhaps engage in some peer-to-peer counseling or peer-to-peer discussion. We do have a youth coordinator on staff there all the time, so she is there. If the students reach out, she's got resources and so on. But we've only been open for about 9 months. We opened the first day of school last year, but so far we've had lots of students coming in and making use of this. It's kind of an intermediary, if you will, a safe space, a welcoming space, just for students to go to and hang out.
I like that. So Tom, what do you think about that, Liz?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it kind of adds into that conversation of creating safe spaces that maybe aren't necessarily labeled as mental health hubs that don't necessarily have that draw in case there are students who are kind of put off by that. But you create a sense of community. You create a sense of this is a space where you can talk and you don't, again, have to purchase anything or do anything. You can just have an environment in which people around you can have some conversations around things or just have a safe space to go home to so that if you have students who maybe don't have that sort of environment outside of that, they have at least kind of a hub that they can return to as well.
Mm-hmm. So the comfort of having someone who has a shared experience is valuable.
Having a shared experience, feeling a part of a community. I co-founded with my friend Laura Dizon, Shout Out Loud MN as in Minnesota. It's a charity for suicide prevention and awareness, and it's in St. Louis Park, Tom. And this is an event for kids and families to come and have a shared experience around mental wellness and learning coping skills and doing art. And this event will be in October, and we're super excited about it. And, really talking to kids about this is all the things that you can do. to really stay focused on your wellness. And you can talk about suicide. You can talk about depression. And in St. Louis Park, you know, they just recently, in the St. Louis Park district, in the schools, they just recently won a grant for mental health resources in that district from Prairie Care Child and Family Fund, where they can do what they need to in the schools to increase their mental health resources. So from whatever it is they need. And so this is going to really help that aspect too, along with the NEST, which is a great, great program that you guys started.
What is Synergy E-Therapy, Dr. Lisa? What is that?
Yeah, Synergy E-Therapy is a telemental health group practice that I began several years ago. And we increase access to mental health care to anybody in the entire state that we're licensed. So I'm licensed in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and New York, so I can see anybody in any of those states. And we have several of us providers who are licensed therapists and psychologists that are really doing the same thing. They want to reach people where we can't be reached sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. If you're in a rural area or in a smaller town, or you don't have that many resources, we can see people by phone and video from the comfort of their home. So they don't need to go anywhere. They don't need to leave work. Or if you are in a big city and you have lots of options and you just are traveling a lot around the state, or you have a busy family at home, I'll have therapy sessions last night from 9 to 11 p.m. and I was able to see some of the people that I work with. So that's what Synergy E-Therapy is all about, is increasing access and reducing the stigma.
That's cool. I want to ask about social media and technology. I think we talked about this before we went on the air. And what impact have we seen that have on the mental health of teenagers and young adults? Because, you know, that was not something that was an option when I was growing up. And I think about what I was going through in high school. It ended when I got on the bus and came home. But now anything that is problematic, it doesn't stop. You have access to it 24 hours a day. Liz, can you speak to that, what you hear from young people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the world is just getting more and more complicated every day. And I mean, social media and the internet definitely doesn't make it simpler. As you mentioned, you know, so much of it has to be online nowadays, you know, not only kind of what you're doing in person, but how you're interacting with others, what resources you're seeing, anything that you're kind of interacting with. And it's definitely becoming a point where people talk about it, you know, where so many of the conversations that I have with students can be about, you know, well, my friend isn't texting me back because of these reasons, or, you know, or they're struggling with stuff that they're seeing online. You know, they're starting to question a lot of things that they used to hold dear. And it's definitely becoming way, way more part of the dialogue, and something that we, especially as mental health educators, now have to start thinking about. Like, how do we not only talk about what's happening in the real world and happening in their heads, but what about the stuff that's happening online and what's happening within their kind of day-to-day interactions, especially in a digital space?
But what do you do? Because that is how the majority of teenagers, how they communicate, is through Instagram, through Snapchat. And through texting. So by removing that, then you can create a new problem by, you know, making them feel like, you know, ostracized. So What would you suggest for parents to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really good to see both the positives and the negatives of it. You know, I think so oftentimes we do talk a lot about the negative things. And I mean, we do see studies that show that higher rates of social media use, higher rates of being on the phone can cause or exacerbate some mental health issues. But there's also a lot of really good things that I think we don't talk about. You know, for example, there's a lot of fantastic mental health applications out there. Teens can download them on their phones, really anyone can, and they can manage mood, they can teach you coping skills, they can work through a lot of the harder moments, and even keep you safe if you're feeling suicidal. Same thing too, you know, there's resources like the crisis text line that I mentioned, you know, where instead of now having to call and talk to someone in person, if you're stressed out at school and you need someone to talk to, if you're having a bad day or it's 2 a.m. and you can't sleep, right, you can reach out on your phone and reach out to a message to a mental health professional who can talk with you about those sort of things. So really, you know, when we have dialogues around social media, you know, there's no teen that's going to get excited about hearing all the negatives and why they shouldn't be using it. So let's see if we can shift our conversation to talking about maybe some of the more healthy ways that they can use
some
it,
good ways,
as well as some of the really awesome resources that are out there.
Dr. Lisa, I see you nodding. What would you say to parents who are struggling with, well, how do I help manage what's happening on that phone?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. And we talk about this a lot as well with the kids that I see and the families, because, you know, kids' brains aren't fully developed yet to see the consequences of some of their choices and their behaviors. And now they have this platform where it's going to be out there forever. So what we talk about is that balance. You know, at what age is it right for your child to have a cell phone or to have texting capabilities or to be on Instagram or Snapchat? Just talking to the group that I see for teens at Elena the other day, they said, well, even if my parents check my phone, I have all the apps to know how to erase it, so they don't even know how to find what I'm doing.
Right.
Not to give their give all their stuff away, right?
We know. Parents already know they're smarter than us.
Yeah, they are smarter than all of us on the social media. And so really, I think where it goes back to is starting these conversations early in your home with kids that are very young. So we know technology is going in this direction and we can't figure out what it's going to be like in 10, 20, 30 years. But just as it was when we were talking to our kids about sex and drugs and rock and roll, that stuff is still here too. So starting the conversation early, even, you know, with my four-year-old, with that stuff that would come on YouTube, you guys remember that? It's like, yeah. If you're watching YouTube and there's something scary or that seems strange or it's not right, you know, how do we talk about this? How do we say, you know, trust your gut? Helping kids to understand what are the limits in your family? You know, is there a time that social media needs to be turned off? Do they turn off the Wi-Fi? I know kids can get around things, but just having boundaries in your home, having expectations, and really having that open dialogue, like you said, Liz, is really key, because there's always going to be something. And so the more that we can talk about it with our kids, the better that we'll understand what's actually happening for them and what they're feeling.
Go ahead.
And if I could add too, I mean, I think it's also good to also talk about ways that maybe social media or kind of technology is helping them as well. You know, we talked a little bit about the apps, sure. But, you know, if let's say you have students who have friends who are in a different kind of state or something else, maybe they use their phone to talk with them and kind of cope through things. Maybe there are things that kind of bring them a lot of good. So when you have those discussions and you talk about, you know, hey, social media, technology, all those other things, try to see if they can bring you some of the good things that they use it for, or maybe some of the really positive coping strategies that they get after using it. I know when I struggled through the hardest of my bullying when I was in middle school and high school, it was my online friends that ended up making a huge difference in my life. And that's one of those things that maybe parents won't even know about, because all they look at in technology and see is bad, bad, bad. So let's look at kind of both sides of it and see how many good and positive or even neutral things can kind of come out of it as well.
That's an important point. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I want to let you guys know that we have a parenting Facebook group at NPR. It's called Raising Kids in Minnesota. And you can find it on NPR's NPR News, the main Facebook page. But in this Raising Kids in Minnesota Facebook page, we asked some, you know, folks last night for some questions, and I want to share a few of those. This one comes from Andy, and Andy asks, what role do parental fear and anxiety play on kids' struggles? Not adult mental illness per se, but the toll of managing children through a perceived world that is dangerous and harmful to kids. So I think what he's asking, if you have parents that are, you know, very anxious, is that problematic for the children?
Well, what we know, and it's a great question, and what we know is that anxiety, depression, certainly there's a genetic component. Mm-hmm. So things do get kind of handed down genetically speaking, but there's also the environmental component. So what was their life like growing up? Were they growing up with traumatic, you know, events or really hard things going on in the community? And that can get passed down as well, that kind of transgenerational trauma that can happen. So yes, as parents, we're trying to balance everything as well. And that's really hard. And you know what? They're going to see our anxieties and they're going to see us yell and they're going to see us kind of be sad when things in life happen. I think what's really important is that the parents are talking about it. I'm feeling sad. I'm feeling anxious. I'm feeling worried. I'm noticing that you're feeling sad or anxious or worried. What can we do about it? Or do you know what I do about it when I get really worried? Is I take three really good deep breaths and you show them how to do it.
So they're watching us. They're learning from us.
Yes, yes. So it doesn't mean that you shouldn't feel anything or try to pretend that life is totally perfect and you're always going to be happy, because that's not real. So if we can show them from a young age, we're going to have good days, we're going to have bad days, how do we manage it and really start to implement some of these coping skills within our day so that they can watch us do it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think so much of definitely, you know, taking care of your kids means that you have to take care of yourself too. You know, we at NAMI, for example, offer a lot of support for parents of children living with mental illness or family members of those, because we understand that, you know, if you're struggling to kind of manage day-to-day life, it could take a really hard toll on you as well. So we have, you know, parent support groups that we offer that kind of have a more peer-led model to them. We have educational materials to try and make that a little bit easier, and educational classes that provide a little bit of that support. And there's plenty of other organizations that do that same thing too, because we realize that, you know, if you have a parent, whether they're living with a mental illness or not, or they're living with some sort of anxiety, you know, that can have effects on the student or effect on the kind of their child. If they're feeling anxious and nervous about things that are kind of going on, they might manage their kids a lot more. That might cause a little bit of stress there. They might be a little bit more high strung in certain situations. In other cases, they could be relaxed and cool. And so all of those things can pass down to the child, who, if they see that their parent is struggling and they're having a rough time, how can they then expect their kind of themselves to kind of feel comfortable telling their parents about kind of what's going on? You know, that feeling of, I don't want to add to my parents' burden and my parents' stress. They don't want to talk about it. Maybe I don't need to talk about my stuff either.
And as we close this conversation, because of time, I need to ask you, do you feel like we've made progress in removing the stigma?
Oh, absolutely.
100%. Having shows like this, having hashtags on social media, talking about the positives of social media, people are talking about it. People are realizing that they're not alone. There's communities, there's resources everywhere. It's just, you know, we just need to talk about them so people know where to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And in my case, when I think back to even, 8 years ago when I was in high school, we didn't talk about this stuff at all. There was barely any conversation around mental health and mental illness. And now it's everywhere. I mean, we have a whole mental health month where there's so many organizations and communities coming out to talk about this sort of stuff. We do kind of an Ending the Silence high school program through NAMI, and we reached almost 10,000 kids last year. And the vast majority of those were people reaching out to us saying, hey, we want to have these conversations in our schools. We want to have these conversations in our communities. And I think that really says something about how, you know, maybe we're not quite there yet. There's still a lot of barriers to go, but we're moving forward. And that's why we need everyone to get involved and everyone to care about this sort of thing.
Thank you, both of you. Liz Babkin, who works for NAMI as a community educator, thank you for your time, your expertise, and Dr. Lisa Herman Lovelace. Dr. Lisa, a licensed clinical psychologist.
Thank you.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-227-6000 or tweet us at Angela Davis MPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.